So we have to remember to keep all of these symbols and things that John sees in the context of what's happening in this throne room scene. So if you'll remember, in chapter 4, John's eyes are opened to the throne room of heaven, and he sees the Father sitting on the throne. He sees the four living beasts, the 24 elders all around the throne, and he sees the Lamb in chapter 5 sitting in the midst of all of those things. And the Father has a scroll in his hand, and the Lamb is the only one who is worthy to take the scroll and to open the seals. I like the alternative translation of worthy comparable, because he's the only one who is comparable to the Father in the sense that he can go up to the Father, take something out of his hand, and then receive equal praise from all of the beings in heaven, and at the end of chapter 5, all of the beings of creation. So I like that translation, comparable. So the Lamb takes the scroll, and he's the only one who's worthy to take it, the only one who's worthy to open it. And what he's doing in chapter 6 is opening that scroll. There's a lot of different assumptions or speculations about what the scroll actually is. But the one that I lean toward is that the scroll is a symbol for the ultimate redemption of mankind. Because that's the one thing that the Father would not reveal unless it was through his Son. Paul calls it the mystery, that angels desired to know the mystery, but that the mystery was revealed through Jesus for us. And so that's why I kind of lean toward that idea. And so if we look at chapter 6 through that lens, you get a very specific picture that fits together with the theme of the book of Revelation as we've been going. But if you forget that the Lamb is opening that scroll, or if there's some very otherworldly interpretation of what the scroll itself is, then you end up with just kind of guessing about what each seal and the symbol that John sees because of that seal being opened, what each of those things represents. So we just have to be careful, and I don't think that there's any way to be dogmatic as far as what's been revealed to us on what everything is and what everything represents for sure in chapters 6 and 7 and continuing on. It gets even more difficult at times, but we still have to keep everything in the context of what we believe. So let's be careful to do that as we study. So in chapter 6 and verse 1, it says, "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." Okay. Couple things. I think it would be good to go and look at Zechariah chapter 6, because we get, in Revelation chapter 6, we get four horses, okay, and they symbolize different things. But over in Zechariah chapter 6, right spot here, starting in verse 1, this is Zechariah's vision. It says, "Then I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming from between two mountains." The mountains were mountains of bronze. "With the first chariot were red horses, the second chariot black horses, the third chariot white horses, and the fourth chariot dappled horses," or spotted horses, okay? Now, if you'll notice with me that Revelation chapter 6 has a white horse first, and then second one is red, and then the third one, where's the cup? A black, third one's black, and then the fourth one is pale. And so there's kind of a connection there in the text, and I don't know that there's time to really flesh out every way that they connect in one class tonight, but you feel free to look at that and how those things compare to each other on your own time. So this first horse is white. What does white normally symbolize?
Purity.
Yeah, Jesus was promising white robes to those who overcome in his letters to the churches earlier on in the book. And white is pretty consistently used that way in Revelation to symbolize purity, okay? A bow from the Psalms, where David's always saying things like the Lord has drawn his bow, or from Isaiah. What do you think the bow would represent there?
Well, an attack of some sort. Judgment, maybe.
Judgment and attack, that's good. I look at it as just conquering. There's times when it's used as judgment. There's times when it's used as salvation. So I put that all together into one category of victory, conquering on the Lord's behalf. And then a crown is given to this being, and he goes out conquering and to conquer. So as far as just what the first horse symbolizes, it would be victory or conquering, which, if you're looking at it through the lens that the scroll is the scheme of redemption of mankind, that would fit, right? The first thing being conquering, victory for the Lord. The second horse, starting in verse 3, says, "When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, 'Come and see.' Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword." So this horse is red. Red normally symbolizes blood, war, carnage. There's a vision that Isaiah has, if you remember, where he sees the Lord drenched in red. And he says it's the blood of trampling his enemies. So this is talking about war. And the symbol, he's given a sword. And I've read some things about how this sword is different than the word for sword that's used for, like, the sword of the Spirit, or the sword that's going to come out of Jesus' mouth in judgment in the letters to the churches. And that this sword is one that would have, like, it's a great sword. It's much larger than the Roman short sword that's used in other places. But this Greek word is a large sword, and they say that is indicative of, like, military infighting, not just a symbol for the word, but that this would be military-style warfare. And again, if you're viewing these seals through the lens of the scroll being the scheme of redemption, then it would fit that this would be persecution, the death, the physical carnage of Christians that was coming. In verse 5, it says, "When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come and see.' So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine.'" So, you know, scales, as far as Western culture is concerned, would represent, like, the law, judgment, right? That's the picture we get in our minds. But if you think about the marketplace and how you would buy things, buy food, you would weigh out what things were worth and how much you were willing to give for it. And they had to be even. And it talks about that a lot in the prophets, how God values honest scales and he condemns dishonest scales, right? So the scales would have been more about economy in Eastern culture than they would be about judgment and justice in our thinking. Wheat and barley were common foods. Oil and wine were more luxurious. So a lot of the commentators see a line being drawn there that the wheat and the barley are going to suffer, that the common people are going to have nothing, but that the rich and those in power, the evil in this case, would be doing well in an earthly way, but that there would be a shortage for Christians. And so this third horse seems to symbolize hardship and suffering through prejudice. And then in verse 7, it says, "When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, 'Come and see.' So I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth." So the fourth horse, I mean, it's named. We know what this one represents. It's death. And the rider is personified death. We're not necessarily told that any of the others are a certain thing that's personified, like the third horse could be famine, like was the rider, or the second horse could be war, was the rider. But this one we're actually told death is the rider of this horse, and Hades followed with him. There's a lot of conjecture, if you read about Revelation, about in what way Hades is represented here that John sees, because it's just the, literally speaking, it just means the realm of the unseen, as far as the way that the language would have used Hades, but it doesn't really matter because death and Hades are always together. Death, you know, brings the living into Hades. So they don't need to be, it doesn't really need to be fleshed out what exactly Hades looks like in this picture. Power was given to them over a fourth of the earth. Okay, so that means that, you know, Romans 13 says there is no authority unless it comes from God. There's power being given to death here for death to do death's thing and to kill. But that authority comes from Jesus. It's not as though death is in opposition here to the Lord. It's death is working in the will of the Lord. And it's over a fourth of the earth to kill with various things. And so most commentators, since the other ones don't specify talking about a larger group, they would say that those are just talking about Christians. But that this one says a fourth of the earth. So that would be a broader scale, and maybe judgment on the world in general, not just suffering for Christians. Then in verse 9, it says, "When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, 'How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?' Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed." There's a few interesting things here. So we know There's some interpretations that would say that the first bit, I don't know exactly where they draw the line, but the first bit of the book of Revelation is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And then there are also some interpretations that say it's talking about the end times, right? My position is that it's somewhere in the middle. It's just during the Roman persecution of Christians, right? And this really shows us that it is definitely during the Christian dispensation after the coming of the kingdom of the Lord, and Christians are being persecuted. So I think that gives evidence to the fact that it's somewhere between those two things, right? That it's under the Roman persecution. And the significance of the altar there in verse 9, I had been thinking about this the other day, that these people had given their lives, right? And it says that they are under the altar. And I always thought that was a little bit strange. It's kind of hard for me to picture that in my mind, that these souls would be underneath the altar. But the practice, when, you know, all the blood had been drained out of the sacrifice, is that the blood would be underneath the altar, around and underneath and inside the altar. And so with God explaining that the life is in the blood, it makes sense that those who had poured out their life would be in that place where the blood of sacrifices would be. So that's kind of how I picture that. And in verse 10, they're asking for judgment. It says, how long until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? But a white robe is given to them. So, you know, a reward that symbolizes purity, just like in the letters to the churches. And they're told just to be patient, that more people are going to follow in their steps and be martyred for the gospel, for Jesus, and that that needed to be completed before judgment could be rendered on the earth. And then in verse 12, it says, I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place, and the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Okay. The reason that a lot of people think that this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem is a lot of the language used in those few verses. So if you look at Matthew chapter 24, in verse 29, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven. The powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. So in that context where Jesus has been talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, there's a lot of the same language being used, right? But the thing is that this language is very common for judgment. You can look through the prophets. You can look at Isaiah 13. I'll go read there real quick. Isaiah 13, verse 10. This is talking about judgment against Babylon. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Okay, so that's a lot of the same language being used just for judgment for, guess what? A government, a nation. And then in chapter 29, number 6, this is a woe pronounced on Jerusalem. You will be punished by the Lord of hosts with thunder and earthquake and great noise, with storm and tempest and the flame of devouring fire. So there we get some of the other stuff. We got the sun being darkened, the great earthquake, the stars of heaven not giving their light, falling to the earth, the moon becoming like blood. So a lot of this language is used in multiple places, not just talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Joel does use it to describe the destruction of Jerusalem. In Joel chapter 2, in verse 31, where he says, the sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. Okay. So Joel does use it that way. But what's important to note is that each time it's used, it's talking about judgment, destruction for a physical government, for a physical nation, a physical kingdom. And we have to keep that, you know, keep that interpretation of this kind of language and put it in the context of where we're at in history, what's going on, and even what John said in the first chapter, that these are things which must shortly come to pass, right? Then you get verse 15, where it says, kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man, talking about stations in a physical nation, right? They're the ones saying, fall on us to the mountains and hide us. So my understanding of verses 12 through 17 is that this is talking about the destruction of Rome, the defeat of Rome. And so with that, we kind of have to zoom out a little bit, I think, for chapter 6. And from my perspective, if we're going to take the position that the scroll is the redemption of Christians, okay, then chapter 6 just kind of follows the trail of that. There's conquest through Jesus, and then there's war and persecution, there's prejudice and persecution, there's death, there's the martyrs who had endured all of those things and died because of them, and then there's the destruction of Rome. So it, you know, it follows the timeline of what's about to happen if you take that position. So I think it's important to keep it in context of what chapter 5 is talking about. Do we have any comments or questions? Don't ask anything too hard. Just kidding. Over chapter 6. I don't know. I don't know the significance. I mean, what I would do to figure it out is just go back through the Bible and look at, like, when is the color black mentioned and in what context it is. Probably mourning, grief, sorrow, repentance, maybe. But that would be the way I kind of tried to figure it out. If there's no other questions or comments for chapter 6, we'll move on to chapter 7. Just about every commentator I've read calls this the interlude, because the Lamb opens 6 of the 7 seals, and then chapter 7 just kind of gets thrown in there as like an intermission from the opening of the seals. So in chapter 7, we're not changing visions, we're not changing context. It's just that changing topics a little bit. Okay. In verse 1, John says, "After these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, the sea, or on any tree." So, if you read in Zechariah chapter 6, it pairs the first four seals and the four winds, the horses, the chariots, as they're mentioned in Zechariah 6, and the winds. The way that I see this, though, is that in chapter 6, the horsemen are being sent out for specific purposes, right? And then for the winds, the only indications we have in Scripture of what that represents is just destruction and judgment. God's power to destroy the winds. And there's angels holding back the winds so that they should not blow on the earth. Okay? So that's what we get in verse 1. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 49, there's an example of the language being used this way. Jeremiah 49 and verse 36, which says, "Against Elam I will bring the four winds from the four quarters of heaven, and scatter them toward all those winds. There shall be no nations where the outcasts of Elam will not go." So there's the four winds being used as a description of destruction and judgment. In verse 2, it says, "Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, 'Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads.'" A couple things. In the original language, then I saw another angel, indicates that John sees another of the same beings, that it's not something different, but that this one has a different job. So there's four angels holding back the winds, and then another angel comes and has the seal. This is a seal like, you know, take the 1200s, for example, they'd write a letter, put wax on it to seal it, right? And then the king would have his seal, a crest or something that would show that that belonged to him, and he would stamp it in there, right? We don't know exactly what this seal was, but it was some way where God would claim those who were his. That's the idea there. And the earth, the sea, and the trees, it's just being used to describe the different facets of the earth that's going to be destroyed, okay? They might represent something. I don't know what it is. I'm not going to pretend to know what it is. That'll be something for you to try to study out on your own. But this angel says, don't harm any of this stuff until we've sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. We've claimed them. Verse 4, this is the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. So the tribe of Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. 12,000 out of every tribe is sealed, up through verse 8. 144,000 is not a limit number. You see, God's not saying, I'm taking 144,000 and no more. Hope you're not 144,001. That's not what it's saying here. It's a symbolic number. And just like with the 24 elders being 12 plus 12, right, symbolic of all of God's people, this would be all of God's saved people of all time. 12 times 12, right, times 1,000. That's the idea here. So it's all of God's people of all time. They are the ones who are sealed.
You know, Jesus' language, and it's like, well, should I forgive my brother up to 7 times? And Jesus replies with 70 times 7.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Obviously not a number, but it's like saying a completeness. Like, you always forgive.
Yeah.
There's no limit to the number. Like, you always forgive. Mm-hmm. You see that kind of language used.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, not just 12, but 12,000.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, all of them.
Yes, all of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it also, it helps explain the seal as well. There's a lot of, you know, Hollywood's giving people the wrong idea that the seal will be some kind of physical mark that you can see or something like that. But really it's just saying the people that belong to God. All of God's saved people. He just kind of reiterates it with two different symbols there. And then in verse 9, he says, after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. If you notice, this description sounds a whole lot like chapter 5, chapter 4 and 5. So I would say that those things are connected. In verse 11, it says, all the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures and fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, amen, blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, that is John, who are these arrayed in white robes and where did they come from? And I said to him, sir, you know. So he said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Notice, the ones who came out of the great tribulation. Okay, go look at chapter 3. Verse verse 5. The rewards, we'll look at all of them, I think, each at their own time, but the rewards given to those who overcome in the letters to the churches. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. So they're given white garments, right? And it's the ones who have come out of the tribulation. Notice verse 10. This is the reward to those in Philadelphia who are faithful. Because you've kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. That would be that great tribulation. So here, you know, there's the word tribulation is used in Matthew 24 to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem. And I think some people make that connection in the language and get confused. But this is talking about a tribulation that the church at Philadelphia would have endured. So we need to keep that in its Roman persecution historical context. And then you also have verse 15, which says, therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. You notice that serve him day and night in his temple. And then you look at chapter 2. Verse 17, the reward to those at Pergamos who overcome, says, to him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat. Wait. I'm looking at the wrong one. Chapter 3 and verse 12. That's the right one. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. So there, connecting that to verse 15 in chapter 7, serve him day and night in his temple. And then, he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. Then you look at chapter 2, verse 7. Him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of paradise of God. And then verse 17, to him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat. So we see the rewards promised to the churches being fulfilled and given here in the scene at the end of chapter 7. And then there's verse 17, for the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of waters, and God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. So then you see there that we're definitely talking about the final reward for those who overcome. And I think that fits in the timeline. You start in chapter 6, you've got victory through Jesus, and then war and persecution, prejudice and persecution, death, martyrdom, and then judgment on Rome, and then you've got the reward given to those who overcome through those things. So I think we can kind of see that timeline through there. Do you have any questions or comments through chapter 7? Yeah. I think it is figurative language there in both cases. And, you know, to back that up, in the rewards, some of them, there's a seal given to those who overcome at Pergamos. I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. Is Jesus going to give each one of those at Pergamos an actual rock? No. He's saying that he's claiming them. That's the idea there. Do you have any other questions or comments?